On today's episode of The Good Word, Tom Haberstroh joins us to discuss Oklahoma City and Minnesota making defense sexy. Jason Tatum is Boston's third best player, and it doesn't even matter. And we wonder if the Knicks will have enough players to beat the Pacers. All that and much more coming up right now.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. It is Wednesday, which means we get Tom Haberstroh with us. Tom the Finder Substack. I was going to say Podstack, but I don't know what a Podstack is. It's a Podstack. It's like a podcast and a Substack all in one, but he doesn't have that. He just has the Substack. He's, you know, he wrote about Wimby's GOAT potential on Yahoo Sports. And of course, don't forget, when you're done with this podcast, you can go over to his podcast, Count the Dings. Anything else that you're doing, Tom?
I'm taking care of two girls, which is probably a full-time job. Yeah. Actually, you know what I did yesterday? My four-year-old got up on a pedal bike and I taught her how to ride a bike yesterday. So, man, playoffs are here. And I'm on another dad level, too.
No scraped knees? Is that what we're saying?
Yet. She hasn't had that moment where she's like, I don't like riding a bike because of the scraped knees. That hasn't happened yet. So you know what? I'm like the OKC Thunder right now. Things are looking great. But until they get punched in the face or scrape their knees, we'll have some questions.
That is an interesting place to start. Because we're going to be talking OKC. We're going to be talking a little bit of Boston. We're going to be talking some NBA on-floor officiating and off-floor rulings. And then, of course, don't forget, John is going to ask us our top five things today. Very curious about that one. But first, let's start with what happened in Oklahoma City last night. 117-95. Producer John's Dallas Mavericks lose yet another game one. Now, Tom, I looked at last night and I looked at Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, long, rangy. Chet Holmgren, skinny, but long, rangy. Jalen Williams, Lou Dort. They cover so much space defensively that even the shots that Kyrie Irving was making when he was trying to get them back in it, you can't survive off of a diet of that, especially if Luka is not going to be prime Luka Doncic, because he didn't look right after tweaking that knee yet again. But Oklahoma City just looks like a monster right now.
Defensively, we have to talk about them among the greatest defensive teams in the NBA or of the greatest defensive teams of this era. I mean, you're talking about a team that's the youngest team in the NBA, and they've held their opponent here, Vinny, in the postseason, five straight games, 95 or fewer points. They just did it against the Dallas Mavericks team that had one of the best offenses since the All-Star break, 116 points per 100 possessions. Against the Clippers, 116 points per 100 possessions. Vinny, they held them to 95 points last night, okay? So this is a Thunder team that held the Pelicans. Yeah, they didn't have Zion Williamson, but they had Trey Murphy, they had Brandon Ingram, they had a whole assortment of weapons, that a good offensive team, even without Zion Williamson, and just curb stomped them, right? So when you talk about OKC's defense, we need to kind of think about, wait, when's the last time we've seen a team this young do this, like defensively? It usually is kind of like a maxim in the NBA that you have to be old, or young teams can't defend because they don't want to defend. They don't have that dog in them. They don't have that kind of savviness that you need to know to be and the communication. But the last time, Vinny, that a defense has held their opponent to 95 or fewer points in five straight playoff games, it's 2016 Spurs, a very different team than the one we're talking about with OKC. It's been 8 years since a team has been that dominant defensively. We've heard a lot about Minnesota, but what OKC does with their length and with their coaching and just their ability to create turnovers, they flummox their opponent on a nightly basis. 10-game win streak, and a lot of it is because of that defense.
Well, the way I look at it is this. Everybody talks about like switchable basketball, right? There is no weak link here. Even even when you look at Minnesota, and I'm seeing them, and that was some of the most hellacious defense, aggressive defense, physical defense that I've ever seen at the point of attack, right? But you can't switch off. Like, Giddy is long. Shea is long. Like, you're searching for the mark, but every time you search for something, there's a new guy in your face that you can't take advantage of. Like, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander leads the league in steals. Not once do we think of Shea as their best defensive player. We don't even think he's their top three defensive player, but he leads the league in steals. And sometimes steals can be kind of an overrated stat. You know, you get Allen Iverson stepping in the passing lane steals. But Jalen Williams, Lu Dort, Big Chet, we all think they have possibilities to be generational defenders. And also, they can all score. Like, this is such a weird thing. I'm not saying, like, let's fast forward to the Western Conference Finals, OKC in Minnesota. But what I am saying is sometimes defenses can be sexy. Like, this is, like, entertaining to watch. Like, if you think about basketball in the mid-90s when basketball became a slog, it wasn't necessarily entertaining. It was competitive, but it wasn't entertaining. The way that these two teams get after it, Tom, that's what I'm really impressed by.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like OKC really broke a sweat, you know? It doesn't even seem like they've been kind of tested yet. And this is so crazy to talk about with a team that's average age is like 23 years old, 22 mm-hmm. years old, youngest team in the NBA. This is so absurd. Like, I don't think people realize, and a lot of it is because they don't have, yeah, they have the commercial, right? What a pro wants. But the idea is they weren't on national TV every game. They kind of snuck up on us this year. I had them as a title contender from day one because of how well coached they are and how I thought that Chet Holmgren and Shea Gilgeous-Alexander would make the leap. It's all been prophesied by me to like the 10th percentile. All 90% of what we're seeing in this postseason, I did not expect this early. So when you talk about the way that they have that, they leverage that length, they've won the turnover battle and the fast break point battle in every game this postseason. And it's a huge thing in football. We talk about owning that turnover column. This is what OKC does. They turn you over and they run the other way and they finish at a very high rate. So this was Lob City. Like, we had heard about the Daniel Gafford, PJ Washington, Derrick Jones Jr. and the Lob City that Dallas had. You know who had more dunks in game one? OKC. OKC, they beat you at their own game. That's how good they are.
It's going to be really fascinating because, look, Shea last night didn't have a triple-double. But, you know, this is another one of those reasons why I did not believe in the Russell Westbrook MVP, because we all believed in the round number. We were like, oh, he averaged 30, 10, and 10. Let's give him MVP. Shea last night, 29, 9, and 9. You know, like we just got to – I think we've aged out of.
Who did you have that year? So 2017. So you had Kawhi that year or James?
No. 2017. I believe I had James. Mm-hmm. I believe I had Russ fourth on my MVP ballot.
Yo. Okay. So I think I had Kawhi one that year, Harden two, and Russ three. But like, is your point that Shea, that he doesn't have the round numbers where we don't care as much and that's good? Or are you saying that we should be giving Shea more?
No, that was just my way of insulting the voters in 2017. That's all. there was no real correlation there. I just like to insult the voters sometimes for MVPs that I think were wholly fraudulent. Okay? Like, maybe one day we'll do that. Like we're going to relitigate the MVP. Like, I have this weird nerd thing, Tom, where I can name every MVP from the year I was born up until now. And probably name MVPs the 5 years before that. It's just I'm one of those weird, quirky idiots that can do such things.
I love that. I used to work with a dude at ESPN who could do the World Series call for every televised World Series. Not just who won the World Series, but the call of like, Keith Foulke picks it up and throws it to first base. Like, that's kind of like, you know, and he was kind of like my mentor at ESPN. So I don't want to talk smack about him at all. I adore that dude. But Mark Simon, like, that is like Mensa level sports fandom. So I can't do what you do. I can't do, what is that? Like the last 40 MVPs, pretty much right there.
I could name the last 40 MVPs. And I could do it. I could probably do it fairly easy.
All right.
I did it drunk one day last year during the, not drunk. I had a couple of cocktails. I wasn't drunk. And someone said, name the last 40 MVPs. And next thing I know, they got a camera on me and they're recording me in the lobby of the JW Marriott. And I named all 40 in order without even like blinking. It was like the easiest exercise in the world.
Off the top of your head, before we move on, what is the most fraudulent of those 40?
Russ. By far. By far, Russ. The ones that people think are fraudulent is the two Steve Nash MVPs. And I'm firmly of the belief that he earned both of them things. Both of them things. Hold on. I just forgot about this. Even the Russ MVP wasn't Karl Malone 1 and 2. What am I thinking here, guys? I'm sorry. Yo. It's Karl Malone every time as a fraudulent MVP. What? At least Russ did average a triple-double. You know what I mean? Like, Carl. Come on, Carl. No, Karl Malone's. That 97 MVP. Baby, I got a story to tell you about Sports Illustrated. That's all I'm going to say. That year, man, John is like, how the hell did we get here? But that year, because the MVP is going to be announced today, I believe. So it just kind of goes into it. That year, I think Jackie McMullen had wrote something in SI about Karl Malone, like did some feature, and Karl Malone basically was whining about he'll never win an MVP and, you know, he's not appreciated and blah, blah, blah. And everybody just said, oh, we're going to give Karl Malone a sympathy MVP vote when Michael Jordan is sitting right there leading the Bulls to 69 fucking wins. Are you kidding yourselves here? If I'm MJ, I'd be so pissed that I didn't get my sixth MVP. Are you kidding me?
Man, I got so
much
I want to say here.
I just went
off
on a rant. John's probably like, the rundown. I'm sorry, John. I apologize. My bad.
Hey, people don't realize, the kids out there, the little babies out there, do not realize how influential Sports Illustrated was. And as much as I want to say that, I'm still with it with the times, but I sound like an old man when I'm talking about how important the institution of Sports Illustrated was and how influential that magazine was.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that Karl Malone year, although I agree with you that that probably did a lot more than people give credit for, but it was such a, if you wanted to know, there wasn't like a PTI to understand what the national conversation is or what the way that the winds are blowing, that established the conversation. Like when LeBron James was the chosen one with Grant Wall on the cover, like that's when everything stopped. And we were like, all right, who is this kid? All right, he made it on Sports Illustrated. What is the deal? So this is a shout out to anybody who's worked at Sports Illustrated and made it what it was and the brand it was. We sound like old geezers, man. We sound like graybeards that we were yelling at when we were kids, like that they don't know what they're talking about. But man,
I can't think of the two Muppets at the theater, like the two old guys. I can't think of their names, but that's what I feel like we sound like right now. Old men yelling at cloud. And that's fine. Like those who know me, who have listened to this podcast, they know I'm the most in the crates person.
Yo, but
I have
Karl
vinyl
won it in 99 too. Karl Malone won it in 99 too, which I was going back because I got a big number about, you know, MVPs and losing early in the playoffs, and we'll get to that. But Malone
Stabler
did it
and Waldorf. That's their names. The Muppets. Thank you, John.
I was going to say Wentworth, and I knew JG Wentworth. That is not what it was. So I want to say 99, Karl Malone. That was a strike-shortened season, the lockout-shortened season. So I feel like even that one has penciled-in.
That could have been Tim Duncan or Alonzo Mourning, believe it or not.
I was going to say, Timmy could have won that one, which I'll save the Timmy thing for later when we talk about top fives. But man, we're teasing a lot here. I'll just say...
Yeah, we are.
We got a lot of meat on this bone for a later day.
Yes, we do. Now, there's something I do want to run by you because of last night with Luka Doncic. Of course, he didn't look healthy. He doesn't look healthy, right? With that knee. I think he ran by Lou Dort or Jalen Williams on a three. And it was early, and it looked like he just wasn't right since then. But he hasn't been right, period, right? He hasn't been
right. Yeah, he got tripped up on, I think it was Lou's foot.
Yeah, it was like a right wing three, and he just got tripped up on, like, the follow-through of the leg. It wasn't anything nefarious there. But I look at three guys who are very high in usage, and I know that, how do I put this? I know that it's smart to say if your best player is your best player, you run everything through him because that's the most efficient way to run offense. Like, why would you run offense through players who aren't as good? But Luka had a 36 usage. That means, A, either the shots are being taken by Luka or one pass away from Luka 36% of the time. That's so laborious. Luka's at a 36 usage. Giannis is at a 33 usage. Jalen Brunson is at 32.5. You know what I see in those dudes? Injured dudes and somebody who's going to get injured sooner or later because you cannot keep up with that level 82 games and then multiple playoff rounds. We've seen Giannis break down the past couple of years because the weight is so heavy on him to make all these plays. And Luka's always running around here looking like he's going to say, Elizabeth, I'm coming home to you. You know what I mean? Because he has so much weight on him. I feel like we have to make a sea change in this, Tom, that you got to bring some of this usage down to save a Luka from himself, to actually make your team better down the line. So in a playoff series, when Luka needs to go 36 usage or 38 usage or whatever it is, he has the energy to do it.
I feel like he and Jamal Murray are getting a little bit of, I need to hit the weight room this summer. I need to actually get my ass in shape. Like, because remember in 2011, how LeBron, after he got embarrassed by J.J. Barea and the Mavs, he went into the bunker and it was infamously, he did his own Aaron Rodgers thing before it was cool.
Did he do ayahuasca? Is that what you said?
He didn't do ayahuasca or any sort of retreat. He just said he didn't like come out of his basement for like 2 weeks.
After he called us all brokies?
Yeah, yeah, and after he was coughing with D Wade when Dirk was steal his soul. So after that, he had this like come to Jesus, like his reckoning happened. Was like, I need to change something. And famously, like Spo and he had this like sit down. It was like, yo, you're gonna have to play more at the four and be more Karl Malone. I know he has a very toxic. On this podcast especially, but the idea was LeBron wasn't ready to embrace being a four,
right,
or embrace being in the pocket and being able to play with his back to the basket and direct the offense from there until 2011 happened. And then he realized, oh, I can be a big man and that will unlock everything. Luka Doncic, I feel like every year we do with him is like, you know, when is he going to like get in shape for the entire season? Not just right when the season begins and he looks great or looks a little bit more cut, but we're what? How many years into the Luka Doncic thing right now? I feel like when he's at his best, it looks like a slog for, you know, 40 minutes. But what about when it's the Western Conference Finals and he's got to be as conditioned as the best player in the planet? Like the whole Golden State Warriors thing was built around Steph is going to outrun you. He is not going to run out of gas and he's going to run you to the bone offensively. Like, you can't have your best defender on him and still survive on the other end. So I feel like Jamal Murray, how he kind of didn't really get in shape this season and a calf issue. And then now he's just, he looks like totally outmatched against this Minnesota, you know, Doberman defense. Same thing with Luka, where it's like, when are we going to have that conversation about how he's not being serious about his body? He was an MVP candidate this year, but we're going to have that conversation at some point, right?
I think we're having it right now. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's one of those critical things is that, A, Luka plays so much international basketball. That's, you know, Luka, Jokic, like those guys represent something greater than them outside of the NBA. And that's something that we do have to kind of acknowledge and appreciate that, you know, especially this summer, like these guys are going to be, whether USA or elsewhere, these guys are going to be taxed, but they're going to be in shape.
Do you think that had anything to do with the early exits, or at least like KD, LeBron, Kawhi? Not saying that they were like packing it in this year, but do you think there's anything to the idea that they were like, yo, we got Team USA this summer?
I don't, because I feel like to some degree, it's more of a concept until you're actually in it. You know what I mean? Like the juices of that stuff doesn't kick in until you're in Vegas and you're practicing with those guys. Like, I think they can compartmentalize by and large and say, oh, that's 3 months from now. Like, I'll be fine. You know what I mean? I think Kevin Durant would much rather be playing than, you know, being at the Miami Grand Prix. You know what I mean? Like, maybe I'm wrong. Now, Jimmy Butler, you know, depending on how you feel about, you know, Pat Riley, you know what I mean? Like, these things, now Jimmy ain't going to the Olympics, and he probably wouldn't. Like, he went once, and I doubt that he'd be going again. But it's just, I do think that there's something to players who know that they are going to be playing for an extended period of time. And I wonder if a guy like Luka, who's not in shape all the time, if he convinces himself that, A, I can play myself into shape. B, if I don't carry the weight, I can't punish guys as much. Because Luka does not sound like a picnic. That dude sounds like, I'm not saying he Tyson Fury, but like, no, Tyson Fury is the fat dude in Denver. You know what I mean? Like, that, like, there's another thing there, you know what I mean? Where guarding you can be very tiresome, except for if you're Oklahoma City time, you can switch and have Shea, J-Dub, Lou Dort. And Lou Dort put my guy Brandon Ingram, put him on punishment. Right? Mm-hmm. You ever been on punishment before, Tom, where you can't go outside and it's sunlight out there and everybody's riding their bikes and they hooping and all that, and you got to sit your ass by the window and watch everybody else be out there hooping because you're on punishment? That was Lou Dort with Brandon Ingram last round. That looks like Lou Dort with Luka this round.
How much money did Lou Dort cost Brandon Ingram? like the reports coming out about he's not getting a contract extension and that he and Willie Green got into it. And it just seems like Brandon Ingram might have played his last games in New Orleans. Like, how much did Lou Dort, just by virtue of guarding that dude in the last series? It's a rhetorical question. It's just that guy, he puts a lot of people in the torture chamber. So I love what OKC's doing. I think they're not a household name. They should be because they weren't on national TV a whole bunch this year, but they play the right brand of basketball. They're so fun to watch. And Chet Holmgren is the real deal. Like, him playing 82 games or whatever this season is one of the most underrated stories, coming off that foot injury that knocked him out the last year. These guys, they haven't missed none of their guys have missed a postseason game due to injury. They're healthy. They're young. And they got legs, man. They're ready to hang with Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, and they look like they didn't even break a sweat in game one. So I just, man, that defense and making Luka look so tired and so old after one game, crazy.
Now, look, because we do have to go on to Cleveland and Boston for a quick second.
Do we?
For a quick second. Okay. Cursing, okay. Right? The one thing I will say about Dallas, and this is some grace I'll give Luka Doncic, Maxi Kleber out with the dislocated shoulder. Dante Exum has been MIA since the regular season ended. Derek Lively looks like a rookie. And Tim Hardaway Jr., where you at? Like, so that's more weight to put on him, on top of playoff weight, on top of actual physical weight, on top of responsibility. Like, it's a lot there. And I think I actually put in print that I thought that Dallas was going to win the series, only because I thought that Dallas had to win the series. A lot of times, who wins the series is not about who's the best team, it's about who's the most desperate. And I thought Dallas had to win this series and go to the Western Conference Finals. I feel like OKC, they're right at the doorstep of everything that they want. They feel the desperation. Except that they may not have to feel desperation, Tom. They're just better, right? That's all it is. They're just better. Speaking of better, the Boston Celtics, they waxed the Cleveland Cavaliers last night. The game was never really in doubt. It was like a double-digit game, and then maybe it was six, and then maybe it was nine. But you never felt like Cleveland was really in it. Is this a matter of it's just Donovan Mitchell cannot score enough to keep up with everything that Boston is doing, even though they don't have Kristaps Porzingis?
They have to figure out a way, the Cavs, to get Jared Allen back. They're shorthanded right now without him. Evan Mobley's outmatched as just like a two-way big that can punish someone in the paint on the offensive boards and make the Boston Celtics have to go big. The Celtics are just cruising. They're in absolute cruise control right now. I would suggest to you that they're doing this with Jason Tatum being their third best player this postseason.
He has not looked good.
Not looked good, and it hasn't even mattered. It hasn't even mattered because they play the five-out system, and they got great defense. Jaylen Brown, again, on Tuesday night in game one, looked outstanding. Derek White showing out. He's got commercial campaigns now. This is a big glow-up for Jaylen Brown and Derek White, but it also is pointing to the fact that, like, Jason Tatum can probably just sit back and wait for these guys to, like, carry them for the next couple rounds. And then he can wake up and be like, oh, yeah. Remember how the last couple years I would try to carry this team down the stretch and down in the finals? You guys got this, and I'll come meet you guys in the finals. Like, that is feeling where it's going right now, because if you go to the Knicks side of things and the Pacers side of things, if this continues, the Boston Celtics will have such, not an easy road, but it feels like Jason Tatum doesn't have to be better than the third best player for them to get to the NBA Finals.
Yeah, I think the way that things broke in the Eastern Conference this year, with Milwaukee looking like Milwaukee, Miami not living up to expectations, Philly being hurt, like, a lot of things are breaking right for them to be the fresher team once the finals get here. And if we have Minnesota and Oklahoma City in a bloodbath of wings, because that's what it would wind up being. It would just be the wings just bloodbathing each other. It would be Ant-Man facing up against Dort and J-Dub and Shea, and then Shea having to deal with Nikhil Alexander Walker and Ant-Man and Jaden McDaniels. Like, it just seems like collision course, seven-game series. I hope it's not seven games, because I'm not, you know, who's trying to go to Oklahoma City that many times? But that's what it's feeling like, right? All right, cool. So, and here's the thing, the other part about Jason Tatum. The Celtics can get through the Eastern Conference with Jason Tatum being their third best player. They ain't winning jack shit if Jason Tatum isn't their best player in the NBA Finals. Let's make that one perfectly clear. Now, we're going to pause for a moment to pay some bills, and we're going to talk about Knicks Pacers, and of course, we got to talk about suspensions or non-suspensions and injuries and two-minute reports and kickballs. Yeah, kickballs. Tom Haberstroh, Vince Goodwill, here on The Good Word. Welcome back to The Good Word. Statler and Waldorf here as the old man. look, Knicks Pacers, of course, the two-minute report came out. The kickball that wasn't. The moving screen that might not have been a moving screen, or was a moving screen, but it wasn't as much or as an egregious moving screen as some of the other moving screens. Am I missing anything else here, Tom?
Just the whole last 2 minute thing. I don't know who it serves. Maybe it's just the gambling community, just so that they can show that they're, you know, taking this stuff seriously and making sure that their officials are being held accountable. But, like, as soon as they called that foul, the one against Miles Turner, the screen, there's no way they're overturning that. There's no way. If you talk about calls in an NBA game, technically there's about probably 30 illegal screens a game.
Right.
Technically. That if there was an L48 report, right, they would have to say, yep, incorrect, no call. That's an illegal screen by the book, by the letter of the law. But they don't do that. You know why? Because no one's out here trying to watch an 8-hour game where they're just at the free throw line the entire time. There's discretion between marginal contact, incidental contact, and what is illegal. And so, yes, it was technically by the book a foul, the screen by Miles Turner on Dante DiVincenzo. But what happened to the technical flopping? What happened to flopping? What happened to that whole new rule that we were going to give out technicals for flopping? Because what Dante DiVincenzo did, throwing his arms out in the air and collapsing to the ground after that, that in November was a technical. That was a technical. Now in the postseason, it's a totally different game. And as I've been covering, and you've been on this as well, the game was officiated differently from the All-Star break and a little before then, actually, to now.
Yep.
And I feel for the players who are just like, what is a foul? What is an illegal screen? Because earlier in the game, you were calling it differently. And then in the biggest moment right there, you're going to call that one. And there's no satisfaction on either side. The Knicks aren't satisfied. The Pacers aren't satisfied. I don't know who's satisfied by the last 2-minute report, but man, until we get a last 48-minute report, I'm just like, what are we doing here?
Well, here's the thing. The NBA has kind of been a lose-lose situation because if they don't come out with transparency and they don't say, hey, we saw what you guys saw, then we're going to say the league is in the tank for the New York Knicks. The league is in the tank for the visual of Madison Square Garden in the big market. Like, and we do want accountability. Like, I feel for the league on every single level. Like, there's calls and rule adjudications that should be made and calls and rules adjudications that could be made, right? Like, what's best isn't always what's right. And what's right isn't always what's best. I'm not saying that's what happened there. I'm saying, to me, the kickball
should have been called. You think that should have been called the Miles Turner screen?
No, absolutely. Tom, okay. I'm from Detroit. Do you the home of the Bill Laimbeer? We're going to call an offensive foul on Laimbeer because he happened to graze Michael Jordan's hip in Game 3 of the 1989 Eastern Conference Finals in a tie game at Chicago Stadium. Are you freaking kidding me? Yes, I just went in the crate. Go and look it up. It was an egregious offensive foul, and it led to one of Michael Jordan's greatest game winners, so you kind of forget about it, right? But no, I don't think that call should be made. Here's one thing I will say. I don't think you look at it and say, you don't make the call in that moment, even though I tweet that. I say, if you don't make that call earlier, you don't make the call now. You don't. Mm-hmm. If you don't make the call earlier, you don't make the call because it's the last minute of the game. You don't swallow your whistle because it's the last minute, but you also don't make the call because it's the last minute of the game. Did he lean in a little bit? Yes. Here's what happens in that situation, Tom. I say this as someone who played point guard when I played, or at least when I tried to play. My coaches would always tell me, if there's a moving screen, that's your fault. As a point guard, you went too fast. You don't go until the screener is set. Like, there has to be some synergy there between you as the ball handler and the screener, because you're going to meet him at a higher rate of speed than he is supposed to come to you. He's supposed to be set. So to me, that's on the ball handler for not allowing Miles Turner to be set. If Miles is too wide, that's on Miles. If Miles is not set, that's on you as the ball handler.
You're letting him off the hook, man. You are. 2 minutes before that, the referees, the NBA.
Lies. I'm not letting him off the hook. Don't do that.
Two plays before that, like 2 minutes before that, Dante DiVincenzo hooked on a screen, Nesmith, and then that was 10 times worse.
Absolutely.
So I agree with you. You make that call, but be consistent. And I just feel like the consistency, and this has been a big word with Monty McCutcheon and the officiating crews, and this has been a key word since the dawn of NBA officiating, is consistency. I think teams want to know what time it is. They want to know what time it is. And as soon as you set the time, keep it that way. And so be consistent. And so what is an illegal screen in the crunch time moment when Dante DiVincenzo pulls and hooks Nesmith?
Yes.
That's got to be a foul too. And the NBA did say that in the last 2-minute report.
It did.
I don't think it pacifies anybody. No one's getting that last 2-minute report, putting it in their mouth and be like a little baby, like, ah, thank you. That makes me feel better. So I'm just saying, got to be consistent. And there's no way they're going to overturn that in that last moment. It's just one of those games that the officiating felt like it was out of control in the last few minutes. And unfortunately, it happened again in the following game after that with Denver and Minnesota. And I don't know if we're going to get into it now, but the Knicks, here's the thing I'll say about the Knicks in game two. Same conversation we had about Luka. How long can Jalen do this? How long can he do this? He is averaging 36 points. He is in this postseason. He's got back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back 40-point games, and he's doing it with assists too. It's not just that he's ball hogging. But this Allen Iverson impression of 2001, I've been seeing it, but I just don't know how much longer it can last because Indiana feels like they know that they want to boom, 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 not just pace up and down the floor, pace in their passes. And I just worry that like they can't go more than six deep anymore. Mitchell Robinson's out for 6 to 8 weeks. That's going to be grueling for them. And Jalen Brunson, it's a storybook season right now and a storybook story. But I just feel like it's got to strike midnight.
It's not sustainable for long-term playoff success. If the New York Knicks are going to be a championship team and they are close enough that they can look around and say, okay, we can make moves on the margins that'll make us better. But if you run your guys into the ground, if you're only playing six guys, because no Mitchell Robinson means the seven-man rotation becomes six. Good luck, Isaiah Hartenstein. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to be on the Josh Hart plan of 48 minutes. Hope you're ready for it, because Tibbs ain't taking you out, right?
Yep.
You got three bench points. Like, it's going to come to a point in this series. That's why I understood why when people were laughing at Barkley and Shaq for saying that the Pacers were going to win the series. But I think part of their calculus is how many healthy bodies will one team have compared to the other? And when you also consider pace, when you also consider the fact that Pascal Siakam is not a small dude, Miles Turner is not a small dude, that's going to wear on you throughout the course of a game, let alone the course of a series. And here's the other thing, Tom. I'm back at the crib because Minnesota and Denver started playing before everybody else did. So there's a long break between games two and three. The Knicks and Pacers are going every other day. So even when you change venues,
that's a
travel day that you're doing, that you're not doing anything, but you're flying. And that also becomes very laborious in going every other day for game six and seven. Not saying that the Pacers are going to win it, but the longer this fight goes, the greater of the chance that I give the Indiana Pacers to win this, especially, Tom, if Tyrese Halliburton wakes up and realizes, hey, dog, I can't be out here going 2-for-6, only taking six shots. I have to be more aggressive. And look, God bless Jalen Brunson, but how do I put this? His numbers are better than what he is. Can I say that?
I think he's really good.
I think that he's playing above his own head. But I don't believe that this is something that is sustainable. I don't think the Celtics are looking around and saying, hey, y'all, let's go see what the Knicks are doing, because we're going to have a hard time guarding Jalen Brunson. They're going to be looking at him like, we're going to trap that 6-foot-nothing dude hard and make him give up the ball and tire his ass out.
Let me put it to you this way. He might be the postseason MVP right now, but if you were going to predict who is the best player going forward in the postseason, I don't think he's top three pick. Like, I don't think you're taking him over Ant Edwards.
No.
I don't think you're taking him over, let's say, Shea. If I'm going to go, like, for the next six games, who am I going to take in a series? I feel like Jalen Brunson with his numbers is outstanding. But he's also being surrounded by I love the 2001 Iverson comparison, because those dudes, they knew their role. They knew what they had to do around Allen Iverson, and they didn't need to get touches. Eric Snow, McKee, Mutombo, they didn't need touches to feel like they were contributing at a high level. That is rare to find in the NBA. The TOP, the time of possession, we have these stats now where you can look at through the sport view cameras, the player tracking cameras, you can see that Jalen Brunson has had the ball in his possession for 11 minutes per game. 11 minutes is the most this postseason, last postseason, and the season before that. The only one who has had a higher number of minutes with the ball in his hands per game
in the
postseason.
Was that Kevin Durant in, 21?
No. That's actually Luka Doncic. And you know what? How many finals appearances he and James Harden and Russell Westbrook and John Wall actually had, like 10.5 at one point. I basically looked at this the last like 6-7 years, Vinny. They don't make it very far. They don't. You can't. It is exhausting. I don't think people realize having to man the offense and dribble when guys are trying to steal from you constantly. Doing that for 46 minutes a game is exhausting. There's a reason why Allen Iverson is the only one to do it. Because that dude was the best athlete and best conditioned athlete, like, what, top five all time in terms of athletes to come through the NBA?
Yes.
There's a short list of guys who can do that for four series. And I just don't know if Jalen Brunson and this New York Knicks team have the bodies to make up for that long term.
Look, you got to see it at the end of game one. He literally, like, I know we're all caught in the toast of the town. It's going to sound like, because we're talking about Jalen Brunson.
I know.
It's going to sound like we're
Knicks
hating
friends
on him.
Are just, yeah, yeah.
That's not the case at all. He's been beyond impressive. He's been a much better player than I ever thought he would be. props to Worldwide West and Leon Rose and those guys for figuring out that there is so much more to Jalen Brunson than just being Luka's sidekick. Ain't no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Like, this has been a remarkable thing. However, this is not a sustainable model. And here, you want to know how I know that? Because literally, he almost had three turnovers in the last minute of that game. He tried his best to give that game to the Indiana Pacers yesterday, and the ref said, no, thank you. You're going to take this. You're going to win this game if we have to give it to you. That the turnover where he threw it off of, was it threw it off of Halliburton, and then the ball wound up being off of him, out of bounds, where he landed like next to Tracy Morgan or something like that, or whatever New York socialite was sitting in the stands. The ball, the kick ball that wasn't, like, he had no reason to pass off anyway. There was no actual trap being there. He was just tired as hell and wanted to get off the ball for a second. And it just, and it hit Neef Smith's hands. And they were going to go on a 4-on-1 fast break. That they were headed towards the track meet. And the ref said, no, 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 you're getting the ball back. Like, at some point, the body will not respond to what the mind wants it to do. That's a bit of a problem. Now, you said something about the officiating in Denver and Minnesota. I don't know where you were going with that, Tom. I'm going to be reticent, but I'm going to give you the floor.
I think what Mark Davis did by not teeing up Mike Malone and having not just Ant and Aaron Gordon and Jamal Murray in his face, but letting Mike Malone go at him like that. And he stood tall, like he was ready to go. Like he fired right back at Mike Malone, but did not tee him up. I could not believe that he did not tee him up. And you might say, hey, good on Mark Davis for standing up to himself and not doing the copping out of like, I'm going to tee you up and walk away. Right. I'm going to like stand on my business and talk to you. Right.
Right.
But what Jamal Murray did later, that was 100% because he realized they ain't going to tee me up. They're not going to do anything to me because I just saw what Mike Malone did and they're not going to do anything about it.
You think those two things were related?
100%. 100. Hey, you know when you're a kid and you're like nagging on your parents and just being a total, you know, little brat, but they're not going to do anything. You go back in your room and you're like, oh, I can take this to another level. They're not going to do anything to me. And that you continue to do it. And they still, the second time, Jamal Murray threw a second thing at Mark Davis and he still didn't get teed up. So I'm saying this idea of physicality and not calling fouls and not calling techs, not calling defensive 3 seconds because we want the games to be physical and competitive. There is a threshold here and we crossed that line. We crossed that line in game one. Things got out of hand. And I think Anthony Edwards getting his technical rescinded earlier.
Yeah.
I think that sent a message that was carried out in game one. And I do believe it got carried out in that game where Mark Davis did not tee up Mike Malone. Something was up. I've never seen a coach go at a referee in the playoffs like that, going across the floor and getting in his face without a tech. And I think that set the tone for Jamal Murray to do what he did. I am not saying Jamal Murray should have done that. He is 100% in the wrong and should have gotten fined even more than that, $100,000. But that doesn't happen if Mark Davis doesn't get that game in control by teeing up Mike Malone and being like, you can't do this. You can't go in at a referee like that.
Okay, that's okay. Wait, hold on. There's two things that work. There's so many things that you said that I have to reply to. For one, I have black parents. There is no thing where you're saying, hey, man, I can just get away with anything. Hey, y'all, don't try this at home, kids. I'm telling you. Not as someone who's a parent, but somebody who has been somebody's child. I have never been the expert on tap dancing on somebody's nerves just to see if they will snap or just to challenge them to see if they won't. Let me tell you, it won't work out well. Point number two. Yes, that's two Americas. Hey, and that's two Americas. And Jamal Murray is Canadian. See how all that works together? Jamal Murray is Canadian. And in case you didn't know, the Canadians have not had the best week or so around the pop culture world. So maybe he had a little frustration that he was trying to work off there because maybe his king, maybe his, you know, maybe his guy was getting worked over. You know what I mean? Who the hell knows, right?
Mm-hmm.
Secondarily, I think in that moment, so many things were at work there. The Mark Davis, Michael Malone moment. One, Jamal Murray had fouled Karl Towns like three times before Karl finally decided to man up and bowl that 6'2" dude over. That's why Mark Davis didn't, because he was probably like, you know what? If I called the foul on Jamal a couple seconds ago, this subsequent play wouldn't have happened. If we're going to follow your chain of evidence, Tom, says that Jamal Murray winds up acting up because Michael Malone acted up and was not penalized. I'm going to bring it down to a more micro thing. I'm going to say that Michael Malone acted up because of what he saw. Mark Davis let it go because Mark Davis is like, had I called the foul in the first place, which would have been on Jamal Murray for playing the bongos on Karl Towns, Karl Towns wouldn't have run over Jamal Murray, which would not have caused Michael Malone. If we're going to play that game, we can play that game. And I think that game is a little closer and tighter than that one that you presented. Not saying that you're wrong. I just have an easier time with the one that I'm presenting.
But like there, I think what you're saying is actually backing up what I'm saying is that I think we're on the same page here, is that like, if we want to really blame what happened and what Jamal Murray and like the seed of what happened, it's several plays before that, like how physical it got and that there wasn't fouls. And hey, that's just the way it goes. But like, we don't want it to become an altercation in this series. And it feels like we're reaching a boiling point in the NBA. If that is going to be all how physical and how we're going to let things slide and we're going to swallow the whistle, there is a threshold to that. And I feel like we are reaching a boiling point, but especially, I can't wait to hear how, man, I'm so excited to go into this game because game three is going to be crazy.
It's going to be a madhouse. Dude, a madhouse. Look, you got the owners sitting across from each other, staring at each other throughout the games, and they're on the same damn team. Like, there is so much meat on the bone of altercations. And here's the thing. I'm not going to be a hypocrite, because I've said here and in other places that the league has gotten too soft and that you cannot be afraid of, oh my God, black dudes fighting, so we're going to call everything soft. No, I think guys can, by and large, handle physical basketball, bring themselves to the line, and pull themselves back. Jamal Murray throwing a heat pack onto the floor in the towel, maybe he can't, right? But I do think, A, it's a better brand of basketball, is more indicative of the basketball that we should be seeing and want to see. And I don't want it to be called back. I don't want guys to be called tight. Let guys be adults. Let guys figure it out. And if there's some level of altercation, something that's close to happening, you pull both teams in and say, hey, you're getting too close to the line. You guys know what can happen. Quit it. That's what I think.
I think there's a happy medium. What you're describing, I think there's a happy medium between the way the game was being called last year and in the beginning of this year and what we saw in that game.
Like, I love the officiating. Look, Jamal Murray was complaining for a foul when he was being trapped, and those dudes did nothing but just show their hands. They weren't reaching in. They weren't leaning in with their bodies. They were just being long and showing their hands, and good on the refs for not falling for the bait. I am very happy with the officiating as a whole. Like, I don't want to pretend and say that just because the officials got it wrong in the Indiana-New York game doesn't mean that I don't like the tone that's being set. You're going to have to work to get to the foul line. You're not going to be able to manipulate me, manipulate the officials, manipulate the cameras. I like it. John, open your microphone. It is John Gennaro's time to shine. John, what is the top five that we got for today?
Well, considering that we might be staring a Western Conference Finals of Minnesota and Oklahoma City in the face, I thought I wanted to go back and find out what was your top five moments, both of you, of young players kind of snatching the crown, grabbing the torch, and saying, this is my league now, or I'm one of the faces of the league now. I was kind of reflecting on Ant doing this to KD and the Suns in the first round, but I want to hear your opinions on other moments like this in NBA playoff history.
Tom, give me your five and then I'll give you mine. I will give you the entire floor.
Okay, so Vinny, we already did Magic a couple weeks ago, but I feel like 1980, game six, no Kareem, rookie just snatching that not just the title, but just the entire NBA and being like, I'm here, right? That's on my list. I've also got, even though it didn't result in like series wins or a lot of wins immediately, but that's God disguised as Michael Jordan line from Larry Bird in after the 63-point game. That's on my list. So that's two. I've got Timmy Duncan in the 2000 and what was that? 2003. Yeah, 2003 Shaq Kobe Lakers, where he had 37 points and just destroyed the Lakers and basically ended their three-peat run right there in 2003.
Yep.
In the beginning, Robert Horry was trying to guard him, and then Shaq tried to guard him, and he put 37 on him and destroyed it. And it was like, yo, Shaq, this is my NBA now. And he won the next three to the next five titles. So that's three. I got Steph. I tried to find a moment. This isn't number one, but I tried to find a moment when Steph just established himself that he was going to be that dude. And I pointed to in 2015, game five, when he had 37-17 in the fourth quarter. It was a game five, 2-2 series.
Yep.
Could have gone either way. This was the Delly. This was them shorthanded without Kyrie. But Steph he took it from him. Took it from LeBron. And yes, Andre Iguodala won the finals MVP, but I believe it should have been Steph. 37 Agreed. Points in game Agreed. Five. The final one, you probably know what it is. LeBron's 48 at the Palace.
Yeah, the LeBron demolition, as I like to call it. That's I have a magic moment on mine. It's not that one.
Okay.
So I like your list. Your list is pretty good. I like the Jordan moment. There is another Jordan moment, but I'm from Detroit. I'm obligated never to mention that shit ever. So you guys can figure it out yourself, right? I have a Kevin Durant moment. And I think we talked about this offline, like we just couldn't fix our mouths and say Kevin Durant is the best player in basketball, even though he probably had been for like 3 years up until a certain point. Mm-hmm, but KD's step up triple on LeBron in game three of the 2017 finals, like that Warriors team was already, in my opinion, maybe the single greatest team or best team I've ever seen in my life, right? But for KD to do that on LeBron in his building, to finally have a team that was reflective of KD's talents and his skills, like that was a snatch the torch. You know, this is my world now thing. The problem was we weren't going to give it to him. That was the bad part. Now, because I'm from Detroit, the Pistons finally beating the Celtics in 88. Like 2-2 series, like just like you talked about with Steph. Isaiah goes for 29 in the second half of game five against the Celtics. In that season, remember the year before he, you know, Bird steals a ball and all of that stuff. You know, I'm not doing that. That still hurts a lot.
I'm surprised you even got that much out.
Oh, I steal my Bird. Oh my God, I hate that shit every time I see it. Right. So Zeke scores 29 in the second half. They close out the Celtics in six games. The Celtics walk off the floor without shaking the Pistons' hands, but somehow that gets lost. Kevin McHale was the only one who shook the Pistons' hands. Larry Bird and everybody else walked up, but the Pistons found a way to not whine about it because they were going to the finals. Lessons learned. Now, the magic moment, the junior skyhook the year before that in the 87 finals, because even though Magic was a champion, he had already beaten the Celtics. I think it was still Larry Bird's league. He had won three straight MVPs, and that was Magic, who had just won his first MVP in 87, taking the team from Kareem, because all those things, all those years before that, they were still like, we're dumping the ball into Kareem. This year, it was like, no, we're going to run Magic style. We're going to play through Magic. That was the year he averaged 23 and 12 and eight rebounds and all that stuff. And the junior sky hook, it was so just, you know, symbolic. Like, I'm taking Kareem's move in this building and I'm taking it from Bird, right? Cool. LeBron's 48 special. Still one of the most incredible games I've ever seen in my life. Funny story time. Well, ain't funny story. Funny anecdote. That was my first day as a full-time employee of the Detroit News. Was May 30th, 2007. When I was like agate clerk and they had just moved me to full time. And
no
that was
way.
In the office that night that happened. Just crazy night. And then finally, there is a Jordan moment. because Jordan lost to the Orlando Magic in 95. That's when he was wearing the Penny Hardaway shoes. And, you know, they carried Horace Grant off the floor and all that. And Mike decided, not only am I going to film a movie, I'm going to build a dome inside of Warner Brothers lot. And I'm going to basically invite everybody here so I can destroy them the next year. And that's what he did. 72-10, the patent leather 11s. He swept the Orlando Magic. And basically, had they not lost the game in the finals, we could literally have said the 96 Bulls had the greatest postseason run of all time. But sweeping Orlando, Shaq and Penny, that ended that Orlando Magic team that we said was going to be the next team. Shaq wound up going to L.A. Penny wound up never being the same because he got hurt the next year and then hurt the year after that. So it was very, like, symbolic of, I don't know who had the torch, Tom, but Mike was like, yeah, this is my league again. Give this shit to me. So that's my top five. I don't know whose was better, but I'll just say mine was better. But thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it.
It's your show. I mean, you run the show.
Don't say that. Look, I don't have a 36 usage here, dog. Don't do that. I'm not Luka Doncic. I ain't out here Jalen Brunson in it. You know what I mean? I am left-handed, but I ain't, you know, putting my head down, just bowling myself in the traffic, getting calls. No, this is our show. This is Wednesdays with Stroh.
Maxi Kleber, I'm happy to be the Maxi Kleber of this podcast.
Don't do that. you are the Shea Gilgeous Alexander of this show.
What a pro wants. Oh, you know what? We can do what a Stroh wants. How about that?
There we go. What a Stroh wants. That, ladies and gentlemen, is Tom Haberstroh. Thanks to Tom for riding with me today. Thanks to producer John and the entire team who works hard behind the scenes on this podcast. Jake and Dan, they'll be back with another episode of No Cap Room tomorrow. I'll be back on Monday morning, probably from Minneapolis. I wonder if I'll be being ready to cover a sweep. Game 4 of the Western Conference semifinals, Minnesota and the champs in Denver. But I'll be there, so don't forget to check back in Monday morning for the next episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.
What a Stroh wants, what a Stroh needs, whatever they have to let me see.